from Local 12 Sports. It's the Skinny Podcast. Now, here's Richard Skinner.
Welcome into the Skinny Podcast. It's the weekly potpourri edition. I'm Richard Skinner, Local12.com digital sports columnist and editor with Rick Roaring. Each and every week, we talk about sports topics locally. We occasionally get into a national topic or two. My favorite portion of the podcast where you can ask me a question on any topic. Go to the Twitterverse, hit up the hashtag AskSkinnyAnything. As always, it's presented by Blake, the attorney Mazelin. We are recording this on Wednesday, the day before the NFL draft starts, Rick, and it is both my favorite and least favorite weekend of the year. It's a chance to yuck it up with people I hang out with all year, and I really enjoy being around. And it also feels like I get there at like 7 o'clock on Thursday, and the next thing I know, in the blink of an eye, it's like 10 o'clock on Saturday, and I don't know where the time went.
Yeah, so how does that all work? Do you all just go to Paul Brown Stadium, hang out in the media room, and kind of do your work in there and wait for them to hook you up with Zoom interviews, or what happens?
Here's what happens. So player X gets drafted. We get him on a conference call. It's literally there's a big conference call thing right in the middle of the media room. So we get on a conference call with that pick. Usually, actually, the conference call comes after we go to the coach's press conference. A coach, Zach Taylor, will come down, and then either the position coach or the coordinator for that guy will come down to talk about, you know, his strengths and whatnot. Sometimes, especially with the multiple picks they have at the moment this year, the sixth and seventh round will get really jumbled up to where we may even say we don't need to talk to Fred, and it's just there's too much there. We'll just let Zach talk after the thing. And sometimes that does take place. And this year that potential exists. So it's one of those ones where the work really starts when the pick comes in. That's the goofy part to it. So some long nights, some quick turnarounds the next day. But like I said, we do have fun out of it. And then about 10 o'clock when we're all done writing, we all kind of meander our way to a downtown bar for what we call the best beer of the year, because the draft is behind us at that point.
What do you all show up like for the start of the draft on Thursday and just kind of sit there for 3 hours BSing and
because you never know. I mean, the Bengals don't do this, but there could always be a trade potentially, and you don't want to not be there if it's third pick and suddenly the Bengals zoom up the charts. They don't do that, mind you. But yeah, that's kind of what it is, you know, we kind of just we try to predict the next pick for each team and talk about a bunch of different stuff. And it's a fun time in that regard. But man, when the work starts, and Saturday is just rapid fire, because I've done this for so long. I literally will do a draft profile of a guy, get that up, go to the press conference. By the time I'm back from the press conference, get myself reorganized, it feels like, oh, they're back on the clock here again in another 10 minutes. So again, the time flies, but it is exhausting.
Well, the term that's used among the local media types, especially in that Bengals locker room, is gags. A lot of gags are being had. I would imagine 3 hours of downtime as you're waiting for that first Bengals pick on Thursday night is going to involve a lot of gags amongst you guys. Should be a good time.
No question. And sneaky, funny guy, Dan Hoard.
Dan Hoard, funny guy. All right, well, the Bengals have the 18th pick in the first round of the draft on Thursday night. That means they'll be picking sometime after 10 p.m., more than likely. I think last year's 18th pick went off around 10:18 p.m., so if you're trying to time it up somewhere around then. Skinny, let's start here. If all things are equal and you can get a great prospect at any position, so we're not going to go by like what we think is going to be available to the Bengals, what is the Bengals' biggest need that should be addressed with that first round pick, assuming you can get whatever you want?
All right. So we all are in agreement, and we talked to Mike Potts, the director of college scouting, yesterday, where he admitted there's a sense of urgency. I think we're all in agreement that this team is in a championship window, and they have a lot of parts towards that. But the one glaring need is defensive tackle. And it would be hard for me to see them passing up Byron Murphy if he was there at 18, even if a couple of the right tackles are on the board, because there are a lot of potential right tackles that are still going to be there in the second and third rounds. It's a pretty deep class in that regard. There's a drop off probably after that. And again, if you're trying to get a guy who's going to be the long-term solution at right tackle, you ain't waiting for the fifth round to get that guy. So to me, all things being equal, defensive tackle would be the way to go. And that's where, if Byron Murphy's gone, and let's just say four of the top five tackles are gone, and maybe they don't have a real high grade on the fifth tackle that's left on the board, and I'm talking offensive tackle now, you know, the next best defensive tackle is Johnny Newton, who's probably rated somewhere in the 30s. Do you then, you know, look at the idea of trading back and adding another, third round pick to the mix? Mike Potts yesterday, and talking to him, I have a piece up on local12.com about the possibility of them trading in that regard. He was asked about how important is the top 100 when you see everybody puts out the top 100, right? And how important is that? Well, the top 100, literally the 100th pick, is the end of the third round. And he said, I think the top 100 is important because I think whenever you get any guys in the first three rounds, you think they are going to be starters sooner rather than later. Those are starting caliber guys. Anything after that, and that's probably true. It's probably gravy. Anything fourth round and beyond is probably gravy if you hit on those guys. It'd be nice if you did, but it's probably gravy. So if you can add a fifth pick inside that top 100, I think that's a big deal. They got four inside the top 97 at the moment. You add a fifth pick, you can come out of the first 2 days of the draft with probably two defensive tackles, a right tackle, a wide receiver, and a corner. And I think in that regard, you also have the flexibility maybe in that third round to start moving up in the third round if you see a guy that you want to get, because you've got an extra sixth round pick you can throw to the other team and an extra seventh round pick you can throw to the other team. They've done that a lot in the past, and they have that flexibility. They have 10 draft picks, Rick, and I don't think they take all 10. I think at the end of the day, they end up taking eight picks, and they move up somewhere and maybe add a piece on day two of the draft.
Okay, so a lot there. It seems like you seem to be of the opinion defensive tackle would be the biggest impact position right now that they could take, yes. And then probably offensive tackle would be next. Is that
right? I think the next one would be offensive tackle – best on the board between offensive tackle, wide receiver, and corner. I mean, because right now the cornerback depth isn't great at the moment. There are guys, but one of them is DJ Ivy, who's coming off an ACL he tore in late December. When's he going to be ready? And he's only in his second year, and he didn't play a whole lot. One may be Dax Hill, or you're trying to convert back to corner from safety. Another is Alan George, who's wavered between the practice squad and the roster. So you need at least one corner in this draft who can come in and provide depth, if not a second. And like I think we talked last week, you said, is there things they haven't done in free agency yet? I think after this draft, then you reevaluate and go, okay, we only got one corner that we think is a high-level backup possibility. Hey, I have to go sign a veteran corner. Maybe they didn't hit on – they're going to hit on a receiver they like. There's just a lot of them in that second, third-round area, in my opinion. But if not, then you go back to the market and look in free agency in that regard. So, yeah, and that's where, man, if you could somehow get five picks, you got four at the moment inside the top 100, you get five, I think you're going to come away pretty happy with what you did.
All right, so just looking here at these are the mock draft roundups involving the Bengals. And you mentioned the defensive tackle from Texas, Byron Murphy, the second. He's a name you'll see a lot here. Pro Football Focus took him. NFL.com had them taking Brian Thomas Jr., the wide receiver from LSU.
Yeah, let me stop at the Brian Thomas. I've seen that mocked, and I don't mind it if he's there. I just don't see him being there.
Yeah, and that's the thing you get into with a lot of these mock drafts. You'll see a name, and it's like, well, that sounds great, but chances are he's not going to be available.
Well, I'm by the way, I'll have one up on local12.com early on Thursday morning, and I did one today just to play around. And there was a tight end that was still available in the seventh round who's probably going to go in the fifth round. I'm like, well, that's not fair. I can't take a guy who's not going to be there just because this draft board says he's going to be there.
Yeah, exactly. So USA Today also has them taking Byron Murphy. USA Today, Nate Davis, a different USA Today writer, has them taking Brian Thomas, the wide receiver from LSU again. Then CBS Sports has them taking Olu Fashanu, the offensive tackle from Penn State. Pro Football Network has them taking Brock Bowers, the tight end from Georgia.
Let's stop right there at the Brock Bowers for a second, because that is going to be one that Bengals fans are going to grind their teeth and gnash the Twitterverse if he is available and they don't take him.
It feels like he's not going to be available, most likely.
I don't think he is either, but we have to play the game that's possible, right? Because he is a possibility. I don't think they take him if he's available. I just don't. They've got three tight ends that they like on the roster at the moment. It's not a position that they value overly. And I've said this before, in a Joe Burrow world, the first progression is Ja'Marr Chase usually, and I think there's going to even be more things schemed for Ja'Marr Chase this year where they're going to try to scheme up even more targets for him out of the slot. Your second one's T. Higgins a lot of times, and it's vice versa on the other ones. Then the other wide receiver, the third wide receiver, the tight end just doesn't come into play very often. I'm sorry. It's more a luxury pick than it is a pick that – I know, again, you go – boy, look at all the weapons. That's great. You can only throw the football to one of them on each down. And so I love the guy. I think he is a special talent. I think everything that a fan loves and sees in Brock Bowers, probably yourself included. But I would steel yourself that if he's there, I just don't think they take him. I don't, and I think it's going to be a moot point anyway, to your point, Rick. I don't think he's there.
Yeah, I just don't see him being there. Now, I am glad we got your take on that, though, what they would do if he was available, because I think that's been a conversation a lot of Bengals fans and even some of the media types that I've been listening to the various podcasts over the last month or so. That has come up a few times about, you know, should the Bengals be trying to get Brock Bowers? I've even heard people saying they should be trading up to try to get Brock Bowers, that he's that a big of a difference maker on the offensive side. I think I lean more towards where you're coming from on that, Skinny. I just don't know if it makes a lot of sense given what the Bengals need to address in this draft. It feels like there are some real holes. If it was a situation where you're coming off a Super Bowl title and it's like, hey, it's all gravy, we're just looking to add luxury pieces, then yeah, maybe you're thinking about taking a Brock Bowers. But in the situation the Bengals are in where they have some holes to fill, I feel like they can do better than taking a tight end.
Yeah, and again, I hope it becomes a moot point because I don't want to have this relitigated all offseason, Rick, if they don't take him. And again, I get the relitigation of Sam Laporta. It's fair. The numbers he put up were really good numbers for a tight end. He became a weapon. Miles Murphy was a backup. I get all of those things. But let's let this whole thing play itself out.
Yeah. I would say I would not be upset if they end up with Brock Bowers somehow. Like that would be exciting and enticing from an offensive weapon standpoint. So I'll be glad to say, okay, if that's what they feel is best, I'm willing to give it a chance and see how it works out. But if we're trying to predict what's going to happen, I tend to lean towards your line of thinking that that's not what they'll end up doing. Just to wrap up these mock drafts here, Fox Sports, again, Byron Murphy, the defensive tackle from Texas, Sportsnot, whatever the hell that is, has the Bengals taking Troy Fontenot from Washington, the offensive tackle. And then The Ringer has him taking the big offensive lineman from Alabama, J.C. Latham. And SB Nation, one more vote for Byron Murphy, the defensive tackle from Texas. So there's all the mock drafts that the Bengals were involved in, Skinny, all the big name ones. We've got your thoughts on what the biggest need might be, but go ahead and give us your pick. Who are you taking with that first pick in the mock draft?
Yeah, so I did a couple of them a couple of weeks ago. The final one I just did, he was there, and I took Byron Murphy. It was impossible for me to pass it up. I just think he checks so many boxes for what they need, what he is as a player, what he is kind of, you know, just his work ethic and all of those things, the things that they really admire, potential leadership qualities. I think it just checks every box for them. And with him sitting on the board, I had to take, I did two mocks a couple of weeks ago, back-to-back days, where I just want to see how the scenarios played out, where I took J.C. Latham and it didn't work out as well as the one when I took Byron Murphy. So if that's the case, maybe this draft works out very, very well for the Bengals.
I love the projection of Byron Murphy. That seems like the perfect fit. He seems like a really talented piece, and he's right where you want him, defensive tackle. That's what the Bengals need. But I've seen it now predicted so much that I feel like there's no chance it's actually going to happen.
Exactly. No, that's exactly how it always happens, right? I mean, it's you watch him go off the board three picks earlier, you're like, well, damn it. And then you're looking around going, now what? And that's where, honestly, if we're in the now what scenario, especially again, if it's, let's just say four of the tackles are off the board and one of the big five and one of them is little played Amarius Mims from Georgia, who's only started 8 career games, but pops off the tape athletically and was really good when he did play. He was hurt a bunch last year. But maybe they don't think he has enough tape, and maybe they don't think he has enough experience. And while he's there and a great prospect, that's a spot to potentially for the Bengals to move backward. And so again, I'm stealing myself for every possibility this year where there's a lot of things that could happen. I don't see them moving up. It's just not what they do. They've only moved up once in the last 5 years in either the first or second round, and that was a couple of years ago. They moved up 3 spots to take Cam Taylor-Britt.
Well, it's kind of a useless exercise here to project what's going to happen in the second round when we don't know what's going to happen in the first round, what they're going to do. But the fans love the mock draft stuff. Do you have a second round pick that you've already made?
Yeah, and I'm drawing a blank on who it was because I took Murphy, and then I took Patrick Paul, the offensive tackle from Houston.
Okay. So that seems to be right in line with what everyone's been thinking, that the biggest needs are going to be defensive tackle and offensive tackle.
And actually, I did it where I actually did them, and I don't usually do this because I like to stay true to what they have, but their history, as I said, their history has been to move back on one of the first two, usually the second day of the draft, and try to either get another pick later or what. There's a part to me that thinks that they could get an extra third round pick. And so I traded down seeing Patrick Paul on the board, and that's about where he was going to fall. So I kind of had to hold my breath, like I guess you would on draft day, and he still was there. So I still took him in the second round. And then I was able to, I won't give them away. I was able to pluck three guys in the third round. That's what I said. I was able to pluck a wide receiver, a corner, and another defensive tackle.
Okay, so you've mentioned the trade piece a few different times now. How likely do you think that is that this staff will look to trade up or back in the draft?
Yeah, up. I don't up on day three. They like to package in, especially again because you can package. Like, let's say you've got a guy you like that's your team three picks above you. They've got a chance to flip flop with that team and then throw them a 6th round pick because they've got an extra 6th round pick, or throw them a 7th round pick. They got an extra 7th round pick. Again, their history isn't to move up on the first 2 days. It's to move back, and they've done that a few times. They moved back in the 2nd round in 2019 and got a couple of extra late round picks and took Drew Sample with that pick. I know it wasn't a great pick, but he's still on the roster. And they still like him, whether we like him or not. As a receiver, they love him. They signed him to a 3-year contract. That's how much they love him. So they do that stuff a lot. So I'm just going, and I made this trade only, like I said, I usually hate to do it because it's like, you're really playing mythical draft football here. But their history in the last 5 years is to do that. And so I thought, okay, historically, if they've done it, I'm going to do it too and add an extra 3rd round pick to the mix, because I do think getting an extra pick in the top 100 is a big deal.
Yeah, and you mentioned, so the way you did it, you traded back, you ended up with 3 picks in that 3rd round. So you went off defensive tackle, offensive tackle, and then what'd you do? You went cornerback, receiver?
I went, well, in order, I went wide receiver, cornerback, well, wide receiver, defensive tackle, cornerback.
Okay.
And then I started the 4th round with another cornerback.
Okay, so you're thinking defensive backs are likely in that second day?
Yes. Yeah, at least one, I think, yeah, at least one on the second day and then one on day three.
Okay. And then how likely do you feel a receiver is, or are we looking at potentially receiver, tight end sometime in the later rounds? Like, what's your thoughts on adding another playmaker to the offense?
Yeah, I don't think another receiver. It's possible. Again, I don't know if they keep all those picks. I ended up keeping the 6th and 7th round. The pick I ended up trading, I think, if I remember right, was a 5th round pick. So they lost the 5th round pick for me. So I ended up keeping the 2 6ths and the 2 7ths. I'm drafting a punter too, by the way. I may change that, but at the moment I'm drafting a punter in the 7th round to add competition. I think they're probably going to go veteran guy to compete in camp, but that's the one pick I'm still wavering on.
Drew Chrisman is trying out for the CFL or something this week, I believe I saw on TikTok. So just
yeah.
Keep that bit alive.
He's trying.
Yeah. Anything else draft related here for the Bengals? Anything that I didn't ask you about, or thoughts that you've had as we've been leading up? I know there's so much stuff out there now with all you guys doing these things, sort of like a month leading up, that I've heard so many things. I feel like maybe I'm forgetting something.
No, I don't think you are forgetting anything. I just the conversation with Mike Potts, the director of college scouting, that we had on Tuesday, I thought was really interesting. You know, he didn't give anything away, mind you, but just kind of the process and the position groups that he said were deep. He actually mentioned the possibility of, you know, we've got the ammo to trade up or trade back. So to me, I mean, trading up still is, I'm not poo-pooing it. It's just something they haven't done very much. So I'm trying to go with history in mind that, again, they moved up 3 spots for Cam Taylor-Britt. So what? And got him in the 2nd round at number 60 instead of number 63. That's why I don't see a significant round 1 move up. You know, I think the teams that are going to do some of the trading in the 1st round, the upper tier of the 1st round, are teams you're not even worrying about. It's just watch it take place. It's teams that want to get a quarterback and trade up to get that quarterback. The Bengals aren't in that conversation.
A couple other Bengals-related topics that I want to get your thoughts on. The Bengals signed backup quarterback Jake Browning to a new 2-year contract that extends to the 2025 season. He obviously started 7 games last year, played in 9 of them, threw for just over 1,900 yards, 12 touchdowns, had 7 interceptions while completing 70% of his passes. Was this a no-brainer after what he showed last year?
Yeah, and the fact that, again, he was an exclusive rights free agent, so he couldn't, as long as the Bengals tendered him an offer, he couldn't sign somewhere else. They gave him a little bit more money. I mean, they only have to give him the veteran minimum, which is still a pretty good piece of change, but it's not what the money I think Jake Browning might have commanded on the open market. And I think the Bengals did him a solid, understanding that, hey, we got him by the short hairs here. And, you know, then I've heard people talk about, oh, you what value you can get when you trade him. No, the value is he's a good backup quarterback at a cheap price. That's the value, folks.
Yeah, so how likely is he to be a NFL starter if he were available on the free agent market and were able to test it?
I think having watched him play and listening to teammates, and teammates are always going to say good things about you when you do good things, right? I think he's one of the 32 best quarterbacks in the league.
It feels like someone, especially with the way the NFL works right now, what he showed in about half of a season last year, someone would have given him the chance this year, right? No
question. I mean, hell, New England still needs a starting quarterback.
Yeah. It might not have worked out. It might have been an A.J. McCarron type situation eventually, but like he would have gotten a chance from somebody to go through training camp and fight for a job, I think.
No question. No question. But again, now if you think you're a championship-ready team, right, and again, you're way better off with Joe Burrow manning that position, but you at least feel like you can get through a handful of games if Joe gets hurt again, and hopefully not, because the two seasons that Joe Burrow has completely finished, they went to a Super Bowl and went to an AFC Championship game, and so the proof is in the pudding. But again, the value of Jake Browning is you got a quality backup quarterback who's now proven it to you and to the rest of the NFL.
And it's comfortable in your system.
And it's comfortable in your system, exactly, at a very good price.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how different you feel going into this year with Jake Browning as your backup, and if something were to happen versus last year when we actually had to rely on him, it's like, oh no, what's this going to look like? Because we had never seen anything from him. He'd never taken a meaningful snap in a game.
No, the competition early in camp between him and Trevor Siemian was honestly a little bit of a train wreck. And then Jake really played well towards the end of camp, had a really good final preseason game, but then obviously, sits out while Burrow's fighting through the injury stuff and then got healthy and all that. At this time last year, you were holding your breath on who the backup quarterback was going to be.
Yeah. Skinny, what's the deal with this ankle surgery that Sam Hubbard had in the offseason? Do you have a rope put in his ankle? Did I read that right?
Yeah, I don't even know the procedure. It's like a cord into it. So it was great. So he shows the scar to everybody and then said, I had deltoid surgery, blah, blah, blah. I go through the procedure. So we go back. We're all looking at each other going, Did he say he had deltoid surgery? Isn't the deltoid up here? So we all scrambled to look at it, and certainly there's a deltoid muscle, right? We all know the deltoid muscle, but there's a deltoid ligament, and it's a rare injury, and he had to have reconstructive surgery there. And again, he played the final eight games with that injury, and there is a line of demarcation because I crunched the numbers. Before he got hurt, he had 4 sacks in 7 games, averaged 5.3 tackles, and had 12 quarterback hits. In the 8 games after the injury, including the game he got injured, the Buffalo game, he had 2 sacks, averaged 2.6 tackles, and had like 4 quarterback hits, and even said, I need to burn the tape of my second half of last year. Well, maybe you do, Sam, but if you're gutting it out playing on half an ankle, kudos to you for doing that. And he said, hey, I did it only because we were pushing for the playoffs and felt like I needed to be out there. I think we'll give you a little bit of a pass for that second half of the season.
It's almost nice to hear that as a Bengals fan, like, oh, there's a reason he looked like that and was non-existent at the end of last year. I mean, it's kind of comforting to hear that he was playing hurt a little bit, and hopefully it seems like he's going to be fine by training camp, right?
That's what he said. Yeah, he said he's on pace and maybe even ahead of pace.
Last thing here on the Bengals, the NFL said that all teams will have the option to introduce a third helmet design for 2025. There's a few teams that are doing a redesign this year that can introduce a third helmet if they want, but by 2025, every team is allowed to introduce a third helmet. They now have 3 jersey options. They have the home, the alternate, and then they can have the color rush jersey. Do you think the Bengals should introduce a third helmet option? They've obviously added the white one last year.
So we kicked that around yesterday after as we were working in the media room, and in fact with one of the Bengals media relations folks, and we were trying to figure out what color would you make it? Would it be black? And what would that look like? I was trying to fathom what that would look like, if it would look good or not. I don't think they do, Rick. I could be wrong. Or old school Bengals. That's a good call. I love old school Bengals.
You go with just the Bengals words on the helmet.
Now that I look at that, Rick, the memories it brings back for me and fans of my ilk.
David Klingler.
I'm kind of with you.
The David Klingler helmet. This is what I think. David Klingler was the stripes, I guess.
Yeah, he was the stripes guy. Yeah, Ken Anderson was probably the last quarterback to wear that helmet for the Bengals.
Yeah, that's probably right. So I don't know. I mean, it's such a basic look, the old school with just the Bengals letters.
The old school stuff.
There is kind of a nostalgia there. I would be okay with that. The other question I have, because I think the current design is iconic. I like that the Bengals have like a really, it stands out. You think of the Bengals stripes when you think of the Bengals franchise. Is there, like, we've seen over the last few years, all these people who do the designer looks where they maybe do like the dark gray with the orange stripes, or they just kind of change the colors of the stripes and the main color. Do you like that at all? Do they maybe just do another version of like the white and black helmet?
Yeah. And we do, my boss and I do photo. He does it more than I do. Photo galleries of people that reimagine uniform combinations and
yeah, those concepts.
Time to time, the concept stuff.
Yeah.
I don't. I kind of like the comment. Listen, initially the white took me aback. The all white. And then they only wear it a couple of times a year. It's like, all right, it's pretty cool when they wear it.
I love the white.
I can go with that. I don't think I'd need that for like the sixth time a year jersey, but a couple times a year, I'm good. I'm good with that. Now, the helmet design, I think because I wrote the story, I think they have until May 1st of this year to petition the league to have a third helmet next year. I asked a couple of people in media relations. They said they haven't heard if they're going to do it or not. I tend to lean towards they don't, Rick, but I certainly could be wrong. And to your point, after you showed that to me, because I've always, you know, I see that in the background when we do this podcast, and I kind of knew what that helmet was, but I it's kind of just barely out of sight, so I didn't really remember it until you pulled it out. I went, and I've got actually one of those real old Bengals helmets. It's one of my keepsake, and I'm not a big collector, but it's one of my highlight collector items that I have is a game used Bengals helmet with that design. I kind of like that. We're not talking about bringing it back a ton.
It'd be like 2 times a year, probably, right?
Yeah, you give me 2 times a year with the whites, 2 times a year with that, and then the rest, you know, your normal uniform colors that you have home and road. I'm good with that.
Yeah, that's how I look at it too. I'm completely fine with them just saying, hey, we've got a traditional look. It's iconic. We're sticking with it. That's fine with me. But also, if they want to go back to a retro look for 2 games a year, I'd be fine with that. I think it's a good, clean look.
Yeah, see, I love the original Tampa Bay Buccaneer jerseys, the creamsicles. I know a lot of people don't. It makes people sick. I love the San Diego Chargers jerseys of the 80s and 90s, that color blue. But when they went back to the powder blue of the original Chargers, I'm like, that. I love that. But I'd love to see them use the other one. When the Tennessee Titans broke out the Houston Oilers powder blue jerseys, the Oilers blue jerseys. Again, maybe it's just the history of it, you know, brings back memories for me growing up. But yeah. I love some of those throwbacks on occasion.
Yeah, there's a certain aspect of that where once it becomes nostalgia, it plays regardless, right? Like there's some NBA jerseys that are like that I remember as a kid, I thought they were terrible. Like the Pistons turquoise jerseys, I always thought were so dumb. And now those have kind of made a resurgence. People think those are cool again. So,
well, I mean, you see the UC when they wear just the one that says cats across it, with the ones from like the 1970s. I think those are
fantastic.
That's a cool jersey.
Yeah, now I think that's a cool jersey in general, but I think sometimes it's not cool. It just plays because it's old and it's nostalgic, and it's like, oh, I remember those from 20 or 30 years ago, but that's fine. Like, that's okay too. That plays, and I think with the helmet, I'd be fine with that. And for those who are listening this as a podcast, by the way, don't have the video element, we're referring to the mini helmets on the shelf behind me as we were talking through that segment there. So, all right, let's switch gears here to the Reds, who are 13-10 now. They're sitting in third place in the NL Central, a game and a half back of the first place Brewers. They split the first two games against the Phillies, and they'll be playing against them here in a handful of hours on Wednesday as we're recording this. Skinny, what was bigger for the Reds this week, in your opinion? Was it CES hopefully breaking out of his slump with a 3-for-4 night, pair of RBIs and a pair of runs scored on Tuesday, or the bullpen pitching 8 1/3 innings in a win on Sunday, then turning around and carrying the team through 4 2/3 inning in Tuesday's win after Abbott left?
Both, actually. I mean, both to me. Because remember, the bullpen got off to a rocky start. I think they had a high five ERA after about a week or so, 10 days or so. And that performance after Frankie Montas got hit was just spectacular. Because it wasn't just one guy carrying the entire load. Nick Martinez did the heavy lifting, but the whole bullpen as a whole, that, or actually Brent Suter did the heavy lifting. Did the lifting the night before. He went 4 innings. And I the good part was it was different guys chipping into that to that moment. So to me, that was big. I've always thought CES is going to hit. I thought this was just a mini slump to start because he's always hit. I think we're going to look up at the end of the year and he's going to be flirting with 300. To be quite frank, I really do. I think hits for him come in bunches, and they're always going to come in bunches when he's locked in and he looks locked in. I think both of those things were big. By the way, I crunched some – you love on-pace numbers, right? Like if a guy hits a home run on opening day, he's on pace for 162.
Yeah,
that's probably a little early to do on-paces. And we're probably still way too early for on-paces. Are you ready for Ellie De La Cruz on-pace numbers I did today?
But I'm ready for the Ellie conversation, so let's jump into it. Go ahead.
All right. He's on pace for 42 home runs. No, I take back. He's on pace for 49 home runs. He's on pace for 84 stolen bases. He's on pace to drive in 119 runs. He's on pace to score 153 runs.
That doesn't suck. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So a few weeks ago, we were all doing the, like, should we be worried about Ellie? Is it too soon to start having these conversations and all that? And that was from the negative standpoint. Let's flip that around and do it from the positive standpoint now, because I think I'm ready to have that conversation about Ellie already. Is it too soon to say that this is clearly a top five shortstop in the game right now? Because I don't think it is.
No. Again, the defense from a consistency standpoint needs to get better. But I told you before the year started, Rick, and I'm sticking to this, A, because of the spectacular things he does. B, because when you look at the all-star shortstops from last year, their numbers were okay, but he actually had better OPS than those guys did. He was right in the ballpark of those guys in the OPS, despite that disastrous finish to the season. And the fact that he does so many spectacular things, he's going to be on SportsCenter more times than those other shortstops. I think he's going to be voted in as a starting all-star shortstop.
Well, and he's hugely popular with the young fans, yes, too. He is like the social media, the YouTube player of choice for young fans. So he's going to get those votes as well. I agree with your all-star take. I always did. But now what we're seeing from him, I mean, Skinny, this is what it's like to have a young phenom on your favorite baseball team or on your local baseball team. It's fun every other night. He's doing something that's exciting or enjoyable to watch. I mean, just look at some of these numbers for the top shortstops in Major League Baseball. And we'll include Mookie Betts as a shortstop. He's played a lot of second base.
You know what? I forgot about that. Maybe I'm going to be wrong on that because I forgot Mookie Betts is playing short and not second.
Well, he's playing a lot of second base, but we'll include him as a shortstop just because he sometimes plays there and he'll get included in some of these numbers when you look him up. But home run, Ellie is tied for first with 7 with Gunnar Henderson from Baltimore. Runs scored, Mookie is first with 24. Ellie is first among full-time shortstops with 22. RBIs, Mookie is first with 19. Ellie is tied with Gunnar Henderson for second with 17. Stolen bases, Ellie is first with 12. Here's the big one, Skinny, that jumps out to me that I guarantee you no Reds fans would guess right now. Guess where Ellie ranks in walk rate among shortstops?
Based on the way you're saying that, probably top five.
Third. And number one is Mookie. So if you're not including him, he's second, and it's by 0.4 percentage point.
And probably he and Mookie are the – I don't know if you're expanding out that far, Rick. Probably he and Mookie are the only two shortstops over 1,000 OPS.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's – and like the K percentage
and
is
I
where
think
he's
we all
really
agree
high.
This. Mookie Betts is – between him and Ronald Acuna Jr. are the two best, I think, all-around players in the game. And we're putting Ellie probably in that conversation at some point.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers just aren't that crazy. On base percentage, you know, Mookie's at .458, Ellie's at .402, he's second. Slugging percentage, Ellie is number two overall behind C.J. Abrams. He's at .641, Mookie's at .612. So we can go on and on and on, and WAR says the same thing. Actually, Ellie is at 1.3 WAR, so he's right there. He's fourth in WAR. Like, you can go to any statistical category, and Ellie is right there, first through fourth or fifth in any of them. I think he's clearly a top five shortstop in the game right now, maybe even better than that when you start going through the numbers. And I think he's scratching the surface of what he's going to do production-wise. I think he continues to get better from here.
Agree. So we all, and I think we all like to play mini manager for fans of the game, right? And we all like to talk about lineup construction and all those things. The one thing I got to give a little bit of credit for, although I think it's going to have to change the more he keeps producing. David Bell leaving in the same spot to this point all year, hitting sixth, might have been a stroke of genius of just letting him just settle in. And, you know, if you have a bad stretch, we're hitting you sixth. If you have a good stretch, we're hitting you sixth. I do think at some point he has to be clearly middle of the order guy. But honestly, if you look at last year, he got off to that such a hot start, was hitting home runs. I think David felt his hand was forced. He batted him cleanup. And I do think Ellie got in some bad habits hitting cleanup, in my opinion.
Yeah,
I don't have empirical proof other than numbers started to dip. But hey, listen, I mean, I'm sure when you played baseball, right? You hit seventh one for a week and all of a sudden coach loved you and he put you in the three hole. And I can remember, I'm like, man, I'm hitting in the three hole. Look at me. Well, I mean, these guys have egos too. They, you know, hitting cleanup's a lot different than hitting sixth. And I think mindset changes. So I think that's, again, I know there's a lot of hand-wringing about, gosh, you got to put him in the middle. I think they will eventually. But I think for right now, you've let him ease into the season and go through a dip and let the production come back.
Yeah, I'm willing to agree that it sounds stupid and it might even be stupid that moving a guy two spots in the order completely changes everything for him. But also, Skinny, what's real is real. Like, guys' numbers do change sometimes, and it does seem like they put more pressure on themselves when they get moved around in the lineup. So, like, if things are going well for this young phenom right now, let's just keep it as it is. Yes. And to David Bell's credit, he's done exactly that. And I don't think he plans to change at the moment. So.
Yeah, maybe against lefties, Rick, maybe because they've just been so erratic and so bad against left-handed starters. And they just don't seem to have a combination they can roll out there. Maybe against them, that's where you just have to say, I got to put you up, kid. I got to put you there, but I'm going to put you back to sixth against righties. Or maybe, again, you feel comfortable enough at some point saying your body of work now through 40 games or 50 games is more than enough to justify you hitting in this spot.
Yeah. One last thing here on the Reds. TJ Friedl, he's in Arizona rehabbing. Mentioned that he's, quote unquote, taking flips, Skinny, which I know you do a lot of times in your spare time, and hitting off of a tee. He's, quote, much farther ahead than expected, according to David Bell, which we've talked about David Bell's unreliable history recently of updating us on injuries. But it seems like good news on the TJ Friedl front, which is good.
And they need it. I mean, they got to have a more reliable leadoff here than what they've got. I mean, you just have to. And TJ Friedl proved that last year.
Yep. All right, real quick, let's switch gears to college basketball before we get into Ask Skinny Anything. We talked last week a lot of transfer portal updates for kind of all the teams. But then after we got done with our podcast, everything went crazy with one specific team in our area that we should probably circle back, especially since I covered them a lot.
Real quick on that, I did not see your tweet on this, but my boss, who you know really well, he said, did something go wrong with the podcast? Because Rick mentioned something about that. And I go, no, it's probably stuff happened after the podcast that it's now pissed him off.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, within minutes of us getting off, I was actually getting texts like while we were wrapping up the podcast of like, call me. So I'm like calling, find out Xavier's got Desmond Claude entering the portal. They've got another commitment coming down that afternoon. And then it continued the rest of the week from there. So we will address Xavier's big week. They landed three players. One was Oklahoma center John Hughley. Then they got Toledo guard Dante Maddox Jr. And then Indiana State guard Ryan Conwell. They also lost their second leading scorer from last year, Desmond Claude, in the transfer portal on Friday. Skinny, as you're witnessing all these happenings, all these portal transactions taking place over on Victory Parkway, what are your thoughts? I mean, this is now a completely different team from what we last saw at the end of the season.
Maybe it needed to be. I mean, right? Maybe it needed to be. I think in a perfect world, push comes to shove. I would guess they would wish Desmond would have stayed, and maybe not. Maybe they just said, the hell with it. We're going to get shooters, and if you want to move on, and we're not going to take the headache of what you want to do. And all. I don't know that, Rick, and I'm talking out of school probably a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, perfect world, I think you'd like Desmond Claude on this team. But right, that's college basketball today. It's literally college basketball. Kentucky's roster right now has three dudes on it. Three dudes on it. And they're all three dudes who were on this team last year. Everybody's gone. They're all gone. That's the crazy part of this to me. And I do think, we talked about this last week, at some point this is going to slow down in the coming years when the COVID year goes away and there's an evening out process and there's more guys in the portal than spots on teams. But right now, man, it leaves your head spinning. And I follow this from afar. As you know, I'm not a recruiting nut. I know you have to follow it far more than I do. And I barely follow it. I just, as soon as a guy commits somewhere, okay, great, you committed that place. I can't imagine what coaches are going through. And again, I'm not asking people to feel sorry for them. I just can't. I couldn't put my shoes in, or my feet in their shoes and say that would be an enjoyable time frame to be going through all this stuff.
The only part of it where I do legitimately feel bad for them and feel like it's almost torturous to do it this way is the fact that it starts right after the end of their season. That to me is insane, because last week for me, from someone who covers the sports standpoint, it was like having a coaching change, which if you cover a team and you have a coaching change, it's like you're not going to sleep for a couple of weeks, all hands on deck, you're just nonstop on the phone. That's what it felt like last week, as Xavier had three new portal additions and their second best player, the best player with remaining eligibility on the roster, go into the portal. I mean, it was nuts. The traffic on the site, the amount of conversation, the amount of people I was talking to, it is just insane right now in this transfer
portal. And Rick, it's funny. I deal with that on a lesser level in the first 3 days of NFL free agency, the 2 day,
exactly,
the 2 day negotiating period, then the first day of the official signing time.
Yep.
And it barely scratches the surface of what those that cover college basketball go through in the portal process.
Yeah. And I mean, when you get a week like that for Xavier, where it's all those guys, I mean, we're not just talking about like, oh, they added a eighth man to their rotation. Yes. And then they lost a guy who's not a big, I mean, they lost their best returning player to the transfer portal, a guy who was going to make big time six figures. Like we're talking maybe close to $500,000 potentially through NIL, left the team, said, no, I don't want that money. I'm going to go somewhere else. And then they added three guys. One played at Oklahoma last year. The other two are mid-major guys who are being offered by like Louisville, Illinois, chasing major bags. I mean, this is completely reshaping the way Xavier is going to look as a team. What happened last week was monumental for Xavier fans and what their team is going to look like. And when you ask me, like, what does it all mean? How are they going to be now? I have no idea what it all means. I mean, like, we just have to see these guys come together. The one thing I think we can say for certain is this group is going to shoot the ball better than they have the last few years. And they're going to be built in a way where offense, getting up and down the court, playing fast and shooting a lot of threes is going to be their strength.
Yep, I agree. I know he's not your problem any longer, but because he's not on Xavier's team, but where might Desmond Claude wind up?
It's a great question. I've gotten a lot of questions about this the last few days, and I haven't heard good, like solid information of, oh, this seems to be the team that's in there. I know when he actually entered the portal, I was told we don't know who's like quote unquote poaching him. There's not a clear team that he's going to. Originally, a lot of people had thought maybe UConn was involved because he waited so long to get in the portal and he's from that area that, okay, maybe he was waiting for them to kind of see where their roster was at before he jumped in. But recently, it seemed like most of the buzz has been around Villanova. So potentially ends up, but it'd be weird. You go from playing for one of the best coaches in the Big East, at least I think most people would argue Sean Miller,
to a guy who'd be on the hot seat.
To a guy who might literally be the worst coach of the Big East right now in Kyle Neptune.
Well,
so
he's certainly going to be on the hot seat.
Definitely on the hot seat. Now, I don't think Desmond Claude plans on being in college for more than one more year based on what I've heard, but even still, it would be a weird decision to go from Sean Miller to Kyle Neptune, I think.
You know, I surmise Kentucky because it's a big time program. I know he'd like the exposure, all of those things, but based on the way Mark Pope wants to play offense with shooters, I just don't know if he fits.
He is like the exact opposite of what Mark Pope does on the offensive end. Mark Pope is like, move the ball. It's pinging all around. You're shooting a lot of threes, playing a wide open style with a lot of cutting. And Des Claude is like ball dominant, playing booty. But he actually kind of fits Villanova, like get into two feet, putting his back to the basket and scoring in the post as a guard. And to Xavier's fans, like to Xavier fans, I would say that's kind of one thing where if you're looking for a bright spot of losing Desmond Claude, I think your style of play on offense is much more fun without him than it was with him last year. It's a hard way to win and play, I think, on offense.
Agreed.
NKU also added a Lithuanian big man, Paulius Rapolis, and Division II point guard Dan Gresger from Michigan Tech. So two guys that obviously we don't know a whole lot about, but they've done pretty well with those Division II point guards. So maybe they'll have another find there.
Did we talk about him a little bit last week?
Yes. I think he happened right before last week's show, and then they added the big man, Paulius Rapolis, after the show.
If I remember right, the point guard's a little bit taller, a little more physical.
Yes, 6'4", a little more athletic. Yeah, and then the big man's a kind of mobile shot blocker as well. So, all right, let's get into some Ask Skinny Anything.
Do it.
We'll start with Reggie Bush, Skinny. He got his 2005 Heisman Trophy reinstated due to what the Heisman Trust calls, quote, enormous changes in the college football landscape, which is that you're now legally allowed to pay players and get impermissible benefits, which is why his was taken away from him. USC will now officially have 8 Heisman trophies, giving it the most of any school in the country, ahead of the 7 each at Ohio State, Oklahoma, and Notre Dame. Did you agree with Reggie Bush getting this Heisman back?
Probably, although I'm going to contradict that with what I'm about to say. So, yeah, there has been a changing in the landscape, right? And the things that are going on now were not allowed to go on then. Can Kentucky come off probation from 88 to 90 for the $50 bills in the Emory air freight bag? I mean,
well, that's what I wonder. There's a lot of things like this, right?
Get all this stuff.
Yeah, there are a lot of sanctions that have been put in place over amateurism rules and impermissible benefits. Like, you know, what did we take away from the sweater vest and Tressel and all the Ohio State guys? Do we need to do something for Maurice Claret now? I don't know. I can't remember what he got taken away from, but it is just interesting. Are we going to go back and rectify all of these situations?
Start giving banners back. Start giving wins back.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Like, is what Louisville did technically okay now? I'm not sure. Can we put their banner back up? Yeah, are you allowed to have prostitutes in the dorms now?
Because I think if it comes under the guise of NIL, I think you can.
Yeah, it's from a collective.
I mean, honestly, you're right, the Hooker Collective. I mean,
it was the Revival.
Yes. I mean, again, I guess I'm glad for him personally, and I know he's fought this. And to his credit, it obviously meant a lot to him, right?
I think that's the interesting part about this, Skinny. It seems like it really meant a lot to Reggie Bush to be a part of the Heisman group.
Yeah, and that says something to me. But as I said, I totally contradicted myself in what I just said. But for him personally, I guess I would say I'm happy. But again, you know, I heard today that the Federal Trade Commission is now outlawing non-compete clauses in contracts, which most of us in the media have. Yeah, I'd like to have done that from the time I had to take unemployment while I sat out a 6 or 3 month non-compete. Yeah, I would like to relitigate that.
Helps you a lot when you're at the end of your career, doesn't it?
Yeah, great. Yeah, exactly. Right, right. I don't think I have another place to go in me, folks. And so, you know, great. I have a non-compete now in my contract that's null and void. So what?
Yeah, I did think about Reggie Bush when we saw Caleb Williams a handful of months ago. I tweeted out a picture from his like $6.5 million penthouse suite overlooking the city there in LA. And his Heisman trophy was just like laying on the floor in the corner of this beautiful apartment that he's been paid NIL money to. And I'm thinking Reggie Bush has to be looking at that like, what the hell happened? I was disgraced. I'm not allowed to even be a part of these events for the Heisman thing. Because I took a couple $100,000. Meanwhile, this guy has a $1 million penthouse and his Heisman trophy is just laying on the floor in the corner of it.
I mean, yeah. How about the poor guys at Tennessee with the piles of cash in the McDonald's bags that they were giving out? Right. I mean, hey, let's go.
Yeah. All right, Skinny, you just became owner of the Cincinnati Reds. What is the first couple of changes you would make?
That's a great one. First and foremost, I will say this. I think they do a terrific job from a fan experience standpoint.
I do too.
You agree? Okay.
The reach out, the community fund, all that stuff, they just kill it.
Yes.
They kill it.
So there's nothing to change in any of that. I would honestly lower concessions. I think they're ridiculous. I think it's absolutely absurd what they charge concession prices. And I know it's a concessionaire and all that, but I think it's absurd. Again, I guess if people are paying that, so be it. I'm not one of them. If you charge $6 a beer, which is outrageous in my opinion, I'd probably have 3 or 4 during a game. You charge in 10 and 11, I'm not even having one. Because if you're having one, I'm going to have a second. At that point, I'm just going to say, you know what? I got my buzz on at the Grail. The buzz will wear off in the ballpark. I'll go get it back on at the Grail. I mean,
seriously. And I know, look, they've done all the math on this stuff. Someone who's much smarter than I am has already figured out, like, this is the right dollar point. This is how to maximize profit and everything. It just seems to me like there are plenty of people like you who, because of principle, I'm not going to spend $10, $11, $12 on a beer. If you lower it to like $9.50, just give me into like the single, whatever it is, like just make it somewhat reasonable. I'll buy 3 or 4 of them. But you go so above and beyond with your price points that make them ridiculous. That's like, out of principle, I can't do this. I think there are a lot of people like that. Couldn't you get more people purchasing if you had it just slightly lower?
And I know the argument that can be made of, well, we don't want you to have 4 or 5 beers. We don't want you to leave our ballpark and get in a car with too many beers in you. I get that. But, you know, sometimes you're at the ballpark and somebody else is driving who doesn't drink. And so I want to have a few beers at that point.
And the beer thing is fine. Okay, let's eliminate beer because you're right. There are other things to think about. You don't want a rowdy crowd. You don't want people being belligerent next to families. Fine. Let's just make it hot dogs then. I would buy a hot dog for $6.50. I'm not buying a hot dog for $10.50. You know what I mean? Like, come on.
The Kroger meal deal where they throw in a bag of sunflower seeds to go along with your hot dog and your watered down pop for $11. No, thank you.
Yeah, it's just I agree. The concessions thing always drives me crazy. And I guess it's just being cheap or whatever. But it's just like certain things, they just irritate you because they're so outrageous when you look at the prices.
From an on-field perspective, I don't know if I'd change anything. I'm not the biggest David Bell guy in the world, but it's hard for me to go against him at the moment. I think he's pushing some good buttons. I think he's doing some good things. To the Nick Kroll point, I mean, he may be all bland and milquetoast and not come off as a wow guy when he talks, but the proof is in the pudding with deals he's made. I mean, I did that column last year. I looked at the 10 trades they've made in the last couple of years, and they came out on top in a big way in almost every single one of them.
I'm a Nick Kroll guy.
I am too. And so I don't honestly at the moment, I'm not sure I change much of anything.
I'm selfish. And being a Northern Kentucky guy, I'd be like, can we get a ferry going over from my favorite Northern Kentucky restaurants over to the ballpark? Make it easier for me to get from Newport to your stadium without paying the downtown parking.
That's a legit point. But if you park around like Smoke Justice, the stadium's just a block and a bridge away.
Oh, I do that. And actually what we do a lot of times is we park right down there by the levee, actually over by the Justice Center or whatever it is. And then we just walk straight across the bridge there. I think it's all free. I don't think we even pay for parking when we go. But it's not a problem. I would just make it even more convenient for me is all I'm saying.
That question that was asked is a good question because I am a guy that would probably be a tinkerer in a lot of ways if I owned the club. Although I'd hire people and let them do it, but I'd probably tinker more than I should. And if this question was asked 2 years ago, I think I'd have a billion things I could tell you. And right now, I think they're doing things very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gives you a little bit of perspective on the ownership group for the Reds is pretty good, probably, right? I mean, even though they've said some dumb things, like,
yeah,
they've done okay. Like,
yeah, and maybe they lucked into Nick Kroll making good decisions.
I think that's probably more so it than anything, but putting the right guy in charge of your GM decisions is really important, and they seem to have gotten that decision right.
And I think I will stand by this. It's never been said, but I've had other people that have talked and have believed this too. When Dick Williams stepped away, I think he thought that the next rebuild, well, he didn't want to go through it because it was going to be a disaster. And I don't blame him for that. But at the time, I thought, man, you guys have got this all messed up. You ran off a pretty decent baseball guy. You're cheaping out. The owner's son says stupid things multiple times, and this is heading in a horrible direction. And then within 2 years, Rick. 2 years since that. Look how it's flipped. It's flipped on its ear.
And a lot of that is because of Nick Kroll.
No doubt.
Yeah. All right. Do you think in college hoops there will be no more four-year players at the same school?
It's a great question. I think that's probably right. That's a great question. I think that's spot on because I think a guy, maybe at the mid-major level, like we saw Marquez work, right? But I would say this, maybe some four-year players, but if a guy has a chance to grad transfer, he's going to grad transfer. So he may not finish with the same school, but he's not allowed to play as a grad student at the school he's at. But yeah, that's a great – it'll be extraordinarily rare.
Yeah, and that was the Marquez Warrick situation where he had the extra COVID year. So he played four years at NKU, and then with his extra fifth year now he's going somewhere else. And we've seen a lot of that over the last couple of years with the guys using the extra year somewhere else. I think that'll be less and less.
Yeah, mid-major guy. Let's just say Marquez did not have that year. And after
he would have finished his career at NKU then.
You think he would have?
Yes.
Because I was going to say this. I think those mid-major guys, once they've proven themselves, and Marquez clearly had proven himself – hell, his sophomore year even, right? Right. I think they would like to challenge themselves at a bigger school if possible.
Maybe
not in his case. But
yeah, in his case, I think it was very specific to he and his mom had made the decision that he was getting his degree at NKU and he was going to become the all-time leading scorer at NKU. And then once he had done all of that, it was like, hey, I've got one more year left to earn money and challenge myself at the highest level, so be it. Yeah, and I think everyone was in agreement on that. So I think there will still be the occasional four-year player at schools, and we are going to cherish the hell out of those. Those guys are going to get hyped up so much for sticking with – even guys that don't have a good career, when they make it through to like a senior day now, they are going to be cherished by their schools.
The thing for me, though, is that four-year player probably is a freshman, as most freshmen are, is really good as a sophomore, and then probably is really good as a junior or good enough to be in the rotation – and at that point, does that guy go, well, to hell with it. I'm going to go earn NIL somewhere. That to me is important because that guy that you cherish may be a guy that, again, he's as a freshman, he's eighth man as a sophomore, he's eighth man as a junior, and the coach goes, to hell with this. I'll run you off. I mean,
a lot of them will be that way, Skinny, 100%. But there are going to be that's what's going to make them so rare because a lot of them will just say, well, I want to chase more money, or the coach didn't have the role for me, or the coach ran them off themselves. But there will be those guys that are either such good locker room guys that the coach is like, we still want you around, even though you don't have a huge role. Or the player themselves is going to be like, you know what? I could make another $150,000 if I went somewhere else, but I love this team. I love this coaching staff and I love where I'm at. I love my college. I have a girlfriend here, whatever. I'm staying. It's going to be few and far between, but I think it will still happen occasionally. And when it does, those guys are going to be like megastars for their universities. The fans will love them.
I mean, hell, can you imagine what Reed Shepard would have been like just to stay a second year?
It would have been insane. And that's why I said last week that his opportunity there was not being looked at properly. Like, yeah, there is more money in the NBA, but it would literally be the best year of his life, undoubtedly, if he stayed at Kentucky for one more year, just because of the college experience of being the big man on campus. It was going to be insane for him. We'll wrap it up with, or actually we've got two more here. Worst non-first round draft pick by the Bengals, Skinny. You've got three options here.
Okay.
Freddie Childress, who was a second round pick, 1989 offensive lineman, came in way overweight, ended up being very successful in the CFL.
Fat Freddie Childress. And trust me, I've done this before. I'll let you finish the question, but I've done this exercise where I haven't done it in a couple of years. The top five Bengals picks of all. Actually, I did it every round. The best Bengals pick in every round in their draft history. and the worst pick in every round. And Freddie Childress is on there. I can't wait to hear the next two.
Okay, so there's only one more name, and then the third one would be somebody else. But B is Sean Brewer, the third round 2001 chain-smoking tight end who was predicted to go in the sixth or seventh round. He was hurt every year that he was at Bengal. Or C, somebody else, Skinny.
Akili Smith's got to be. Oh, it's non-first round. I'm sorry. It's
non-first round.
Those are two good choices, man. And I hate to do it, but Jackson Carmen's trending that way.
That's another good one.
I mean, he just is. He hasn't cracked the lineup much.
Who do you go with? Is it one of these guys? Is it Jackson?
I'm going, no, Freddie Childress. Because, I mean, they needed him to play. Think about this today's day and age. Even if you're a rookie, a Jackson Carmen, who didn't show a ton of promise in his first camp, right? You still get that camp. And usually, for most guys, like Chris Evans hasn't panned out. He wasn't supposed to. He's a six-round kid, but I think everybody had high hopes for him, seeing some of the things he did.
Right.
Even guys like that usually finish at least three of their 4 years of their rookie contract, if not all four, because they're on the cheap. You figure out a role for them, their depth, all those things. Freddie Childress got cut in camp. Camp.
Not ideal. All right, we'll wrap it up with this. Which sport has the best movies about said sport?
Oh, I got to go baseball because there's just so many of them. I mean, that's by far, whether they're the ones that romance the sport, make light of the sport, do both, biographies of those in the sport, baseball by far.
Yeah, it's pretty easily baseball. I mean, just even trying to think of sports movies, it's like immediately you can think of 5, 6, 7 baseball movies off the top that are well known.
Different genres. Like I said, comedies like Major League, sappy ones like The Natural, biographies of players. There's a ton of them.
Bad News Bears, Eight Men Out. Bears. Like there's just so many different baseball movies that I can think of. And
didn't have a crush on Tatum O'Neill in the original Bad News Bears. Come on now.
Exactly. The Sandlot. There's just so many good baseball movies. And when I start thinking about basketball, it's like I even struggle. It's like, okay, Above the Rim, Space Jam,
Blue Chips.
Blue Chips. I have some basketball movies I really love, but
you're gonna hate it because I know you hate it. But I woke up at about 4:30 in the morning the other day and it was on. I watched the last hour of Hoosiers.
Shooter.
I love you guys.
The
underhand free throw. Come on now.
What other sport? I mean, football. There's not even really good movies about football. Blindside.
Yeah, most of the football stuff, too, the action in it is just so stupidly hokey and bad.
Yeah, it's always terrible. And like, feels like every movie about football is kind of like, it's like sort of sappy. Like it's trying to prove a point. There's always like the good versus the bad kind of thing going on. Like the Remember the Titans, the race thing going on. Like, I feel like football movies are all kind of that format. It's like the Disney format.
I mean, honestly, some of the best football action, in my opinion, in a football movie was All the Right Moves with Tom Cruise.
Any Given Sunday is pretty good.
It's pretty good, but some of the action's way over the top.
Yeah, I mean, the eye popping out, but...
Correct, yeah.
But it's still probably the best.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, Al Pacino, shout out to Al.
Elizabeth Berkeley naked, there's nothing wrong with
that. Not bad with that, yeah.
It's all good.
All right, that's all we got.
All right, good stuff as always, appreciate it. We will be back next week. We'll have a Bengals draft to recap. The Reds getting ready to hit the teeth of their schedule if they're not already in it with the Phillies this week. And much, much more probably in the college basketball front as well. For Rick Roaring, I'm Richard Skinner. It's been the Skinny Podcast, the weekly Pro Free Edition, presented by Blake, the Attorney Mason.